Hello, and welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Daniel Friedrich, one of the hosts of the channel. What role do images play in the Enlightenment experience? Can Buddha images, calligraphy, mandalas, and portraits function as nodes of access for a practitioner's experience of Enlightenment? Or are these visual representations a distraction from what ultimately matters? Pamela D. Winfield's recent award-winning monograph, Icons and Iconoclasm, Kukai and Dogen on the Art of Enlightenment, explores these major Japanese Buddhist figures' artistic and textual productions in order to answer these questions. Bringing together her expertise in the fields of art history and Buddhist studies, Winfield guides the reader to a more nuanced understanding of Kukai as a promoter of icons and Dogen's seemingly iconoclastic stance. In addition, she offers a model for bridging textual studies and studies of material cultures that opens paths for further explorations of the relationship of practice, text, and image. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Hello, Pamela, and welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So why don't we go ahead and let's just jump right into the interview here. Could you tell us, begin maybe by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the study of Japanese Buddhism?
Okay, in my undergraduate studies at Georgetown, actually, I concentrated completely, exclusively in Western European languages and art history, actually. I was a French and Italian double major, and I studied art history in France and in Italy, in French and in Italian. And honestly, I thought I was going to be the next greatest 19th century French impressionist curator until I realized that the world could probably do with one less 19th century French impressionist curator. After school, I, like many, who got their start in Japanese studies, I taught English as a second language in Japan for the first time, 2.5 years. First up in Sendai, and then moved down to Kansai region, and just had a wonderful experience the first time. And I got hooked, you know. When I was down teaching at a Sacred Heart school, actually, Seishin Joshi Gakuin, a Sacred Heart women's high school down in like Takarazuka area. You know, I would just take the Kansai Time Out, that magazine, and they just have a list of all the matsuri and festivals that are going on every weekend. And I went just because that was where the entertainment was, right? That was where the good cheap food and the good cheap beer and all the nigiyaka, you know, the lively atmosphere was. And I, you know, I didn't understand at first what I was looking at. And so, you know, I started reading up, and the more you dig, the more you dig, and the more you want to dig and dig and dig. And I got hooked that way. It came down for me, it came down to whether I wanted to go back to school for religious studies or for art history. And in the end, I decided on religious studies. I am still interested. I have a very strong art history background. I had internships at Sotheby's and at the National Gallery of Art and at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where I was put in the Asian art department there as an intern. But I didn't want to just study the who, what, where, and how of art. I wanted to get the more philosophical why, right? Mm-hmm. Why religious art in the first place? What are the kind of religious impulses that are behind these amazing accomplishments of human creativity? I decided on religious studies for my PhD at Temple University. They gave me a nice scholarship there, so went and worked at Temple with Shigenori Nagatomo. But then I also took art history classes with Nancy Steinhardt at UPenn, just down the street, down the road in Philly. And she very graciously agreed to be on my committee. And so even though my doctorate is in religious studies per se, I've always been able to do a very, I've been lucky enough to do a very interdisciplinary approach to religious studies. That is religious studies and art history kind of in symbiosis.
Sure. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I think we can really see those, both of those interests, how they come out in your book, and and in the maybe the three framing questions of the book.
Yes.
I think you list them as: do images help or hinder the realization of Buddhahood? Does the experience of awakening involve the imagination or not? And can art ever represent the experience of awakening itself?
Mm-hmm.
I think in your perhaps your background really leads to the generation of those questions, but maybe you can say a little bit about how those questions came to be and how you came to focus on how Dogen and Kukai specifically respond to these questions.
Right. Thank you. So the genesis of those three questions, I think, had probably been mulling around in my head throughout my whole graduate career in various various ways. You know, papers on mandala visualization, papers on Dogen's kind of Shinjin Datsuraku, this idea of absolute sensation where there is no visualization, no munen muso, right? No thought, no image. So I was interested in various aspects of this, I think, for a long time. And the dissertation and then the rewrite, the complete rewrite of the book, was my vehicle really to kind of crystallize those questions for myself, and hopefully that might be of interest to other readers. I also am very interested in and took several courses on comparative mysticism. So the role of experience, right, and how Buddhists themselves understood their enlightenment experiences, either, you know, or I should say the place or the time of their enlightenment experiences, also interested me greatly. And I wanted to try to bring the role of perception and imagery and visualization as it pertains to the enlightenment experience itself to bear in this, in my writing, in my work, in my studies. So how I got to those three kind of before, during, after questions, I think actually was a very long process. I would say at least a decade. You know, it had always been in my mind, studying art history, but then also studying religious studies. And this is my attempt to bring these two camps really together. And they are camps, unfortunately, still, even in the academy, right? From the 19th century German, you know, division of labor in the academy, that religious studies scholars only deal with texts and philology, right? And thank goodness for that. We have amazing expertise, right? We've all benefited from it. And then art historians, on the other hand, only deal with images, you know, ideally, as if monks weren't artists and artists weren't monks, right? You know. I perceived, in my own work, I got frustrated with this kind of division of labor and am trying to bring them back together into their historical symbiosis, really.
Sure.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit about how, how Kukai and Dogen maybe approach these kind of questions? I think in the book you have this great way of describing them as unitive and purgative experiences.
Right. Thank you for keeping me back on track. So why Kukai and why Dogen? So thank you. I chose these two kind of representative voices for and against the role of images in awakening because of their reputations, frankly. They're perceived kind of almost stereotyped, but at least in sectarian scholarship, you know, Kukai is kind of held up as the very pro image, very elaborate symbol systems, right? This esoteric Buddhist kind of smells and bells Buddhism, right? The highly ritualistic, highly coded iconographic system on Kukai's side. And then on the other, I chose Dogen for his reputation as being, or Zen's reputation in general, of being, you know, at least minimalistic, at most iconoclastic, anti-image, at least in its rhetoric, right?
Right.
And what I then do in the book is I try to nuance these two representative voices and show that actually Kukai empties his images out of substance, and Dogen, in fact, actually does hold a few Zen icons up as you know, as worthy of veneration, really, such as the Shisho and whatnot, the transmission certificate. So that's why Kukai and Dogen. Now, I'm sorry, what, the second part of your question?
Maybe a little bit about how each of them maybe understand images in, let's say, perhaps in your recovery here, through this idea of the unitive and the purgative.
Yes. Thank you. So then how their views on images pertain to experience. I argue in the book that Kukai exhibits a unitive model. The way he envisions his enlightenment experience is what he calls kaji, right? Or what it's often translated as mutual empowerment. That is, there is a certain exchange or a certain divine union, you might say, or deity yoga in a sacred space or unobstructed space, really. He's drawing on Hua Yen, spatiality here, this kind of holographic space in which self and Buddha can unite. There's kind of a non-dual union in unobstructed space that goes on in Kukai's unitive model, right? By contrast, Dogen's view or Dogen's time of awakening, it's not as spatial. I argue that it's more temporal in nature. I characterize it as a purgative process of enlightenment that is characterized by a threefold movement from the assertion of the self, such as you are, like right now, from your starting point, to a radical negation of self in a moment of Shinjin Datsuraku, what he calls dropping off body mind, right? Kind of pulling the rug out from under yourself. There's absolute, what maybe Nishida Kitaro calls the place of absolute nothingness, right? So that Shinjin Dasuraku, second movement. And then from that radical negation, there is a third movement of reassertion of form of self in the world, self in and as, but a part of the world, kind of a more gestalt, enlightened realization of one's intimate, place amongst all dharmas. So that purgative process is kind of harkens back to Baba Viveka's Majjhimika three-point movement, and Malcolm David Eccle has written beautifully on that already. So I kind of look to him. I also look to my own advisor, who has characterized this as the logic of not, right? The A, not A, A again, therefore A. So that's Dogen's purgative process, as opposed to Kukai's unitive model. And so in my second chapter, actually, I kind of lay this out as Mikkyo space, right. Zen time, right?
Yes.
And talk about how both of those visions of enlightenment, or places and times of enlightenment, actually relate to imagery itself, right? And also to their foundation legends. We can see both Kukai, both the esoteric Buddhist, as well as the Zen tradition, both look to the patriarch Nagarjuna as their kind of first, at least human patriarch, right? Yeah. But in the Mikkyo, in the esoteric Buddhist context, Nagarjuna goes to an iron stupa in southern India and obtains the esoteric sutras, right? The Vajrasukhara and the Mahavajrasana sutras in an iron tower. So there's an exchange there. There's that kind of bi-directional, reflexive, two-way reciprocation of enlightened wisdom in unobstructed space there, in this kind of mythological tower in iron in southern India. So that is indicative, I think, of that kaji experience that I outlined earlier. And so too in the Zen tradition, Nagarjuna, again, the legend says that he starts, up in the human realm, but he goes down, right, through the sea of conceptual dualisms, you might say, down to the Dragon King's palace at the bottom of the ocean, obtains the Prajnaparamita Sutras, the perfection of wisdom literature, and then reemerges again. And that kind of three-point assertion, negation, and reaffirmation paradigm or process that I've outlined there. So I think even their foundation legends themselves are indicative of the enlightenment experiences or how they characterize their own enlightenment experiences.
Yeah, so, I think what's really interesting then is, you know, as moving on from those foundation legends, they both go back to both Kukai and Dogen and their traditions. Then you make a very strong case for how they draw on the Kegon worldview and in their understanding of images. And you have this wonderful idea about Mikyo as the analog, with analog imagery where the practitioner plugs in to the Kegon.
Oh, I see. Yes, right. Yes, thank you. Okay.
It's such a great image. I loved this idea.
As opposed to Zen's Jiriki battery pack, right?
Right, right.
That's right. So yes, I do use Kegon or Huayan Buddhism as the common denominator for analysis for bringing these two characters together in the first place. There was a previous study, a comparative study of Kukai and Dogen back in mid-80s, 1985, I think, was David Shaner's Body-Mind Experience of in Japanese Buddhism. And so this book is really kind of the first since then to kind of bring their works together in both text and image analysis. But what I wanted to do differently than David Shaner was to actually look to within the Buddhist tradition itself for common denominators, right? David Shaner's analysis uses phenomenology, you know, Western European continental philosophy as his kind of methodological framing, which is great. But I wanted to look within Buddhism itself. And so I see Kegon or Huayan Buddhism as really what both Kukai and Dogen are drawing on in different ways, both in terms of their unobstructed spatial metaphors or their unobstructed temporal metaphors. And I use the words holographic and holochronic, right, for Kukai and Dogen's, paradigms. And then, in this unobstructed space for Kukai, basically, I it may be a bit flippant, or maybe I may have pushed the metaphor too far, but I see the three ritual prongs of body, speech, and mind is kind of your plug-in to Dainichi Buddha, the universal world Buddha of infinite of light. I'm sorry, not Amida, but the great light Buddha, Mahavairochana, or Dainichi Buddha. And so through mantra, through mudra, through mandalas or samaya visualizations, through mind, you plug in to this external source or this projected idea of Buddhahood. And there's actually even, in the esoteric Buddhist practice, there are actually even mantra circulation visualizations where the practitioner imagines the mantra coming out of the mouth and entering into the Buddha who is pictured above you and then circling back down through your crown chakra and then back out and around. And so there's a loop, kind of a feedback loop between self and Buddha to facilitate this deity yoga, really, this non-dual union in unobstructed space. In Dogen's holochronic model, I argue, you don't plug into anything external. It's jiriki, right? It's self-power. So according to Dogen, if you just sit, right, shikan taza, right, by just sitting, eventually in time, of its own accord, you will eventually just kind of drop off body-mind, right, this shinjin datsuraku, and have the enlightenment experience that way. And that, once you have that experience, the way that Dogen understands his place, therefore, it's not so much a place, it's a time. You are inserted into the Buddha time, right? And he actually shows this in the Soto Zen transmission certificates, these shisho, they're called, where instead of kind of a linear lineage from master to disciple and so on and so on and so forth, rather, instead of drawing those lines vertically or even horizontally along a hand scroll, right? Rather, on the hanging scroll, he has every name of all the Buddhist patriarchs radiating around the Buddha's name in the center in a circle. So that, he says, actually, all the Buddhas and patriarchs are shoulder to shoulder with one another, kind of side by side, radiating around the central Buddha name in the middle, Buddha mind in the middle. And then furthermore, there's a actually connecting or linking all of these Buddha names around that circle. There's a red line that kind of weaves in and around each name, calligraphic, you know, written name, so that it's a kechimyaku, right? It's a blood lineage, a surrogate bloodline that connects the Buddha, right, as the ultimate kind of great, 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 great grandfather of all the Buddhas, right? With around, and then Dogen inserts himself at the bottom of that transmission certificate as but the latest heir to that Buddha mind, right? And ultimately connected with both the first and the last Buddhist patriarch, shoulder to shoulder with both of them in this kind of trans-historical, very cyclical, circular, non-linear idea of time.
Right. Yeah. All right. Boy, let's see. I feel like
that's a lot. I know.
Yeah, that's a lot.
I find it fascinating, but yeah, it's a lot.
Let's see. Yeah, I think that one of the interesting things here is this idea of the enlightenment certificate as an image.
Ah, yes.
Right. That I feel. So maybe can you say a little bit more about that? I don't, because I often think we don't think of the Shiso as an image as such.
Good. Thank you. Yes. Yes. If you were to ask, and I have asked Soto Zen scholars in Japan, you know, about the Shisho, first of all, it was not made public until very recently. It was a deeply held kind of an internal image that was really actually venerated within the Soto Zen context for centuries, really. Right. It was held. Now, there are some scholars, art historians, actually, who question the whether it's authentic, whether it's actually Dogen, what Dogen brought back from China, or if it's a medieval copy. And there are, you know, debates about that. But it functions, functionally it acts as an icon. It is, Dogen himself writes about how he goes to China and he views other shisho, other transmission certificates, and his excitement at seeing them is almost akin to an art historian's, you know, idea of getting into the private collections or a museum collections that's not out on public display. There's a certain power. Mm-hmm. And authenticity and special nature to this, yes, calligraphic written text that is mounted like, you know, on a kakemono, on a hanging scroll, that gets displayed only on special occasions. So it functions like an icon, right? And people bow before the shisho. So there is a sense of that this image, this visual object in and of itself has the kind of cachet, has the kind of power, has the kind of presence, really, almost as that's interchangeable with, for example, a Chinzo master portrait, right? That Bob Sharf and other and Griff Folk have argued functions effectively like a double for a departed master. So these sorts of the investment and the kind of emotional valence that these shisho have is very akin to an icon, right? To an image of enlightenment. It's like a piece of holiness, mm-hmm. right? that they're engaging with here. Right. It's not just picking up a book and reading the lineage, right? Mm-hmm. It's venerated as icons were venerated.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think too, one of the interesting moves you make in your book is when you're unpacking why Dogen chose this kind of image, these mm-hmm. shisho, rather than the paintings of the moon, right? Mm-hmm. Right. What a rice cake, I think, is what Dogen.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. All right. So these. Can you maybe say a little bit about why Dogen maybe rejects these other kind of images that we might expect to see other Buddhist figures pointing towards? So.
Right. So Dogen is hard to pin down about anything, really. And his views on imagery are no different. Mm-hmm. And I think you often have to consider who his audience was, when and where he's speaking, and whether he is speaking from a pre-enlightenment or a post-enlightenment perspective, right? So there are sometimes, for example, this example of Nagarjuna as the in Full Moon Samadhi, where he, Dogen, so let me tell the little, can
sure.
I tell the story a little
of course.
Bit?
Yes, okay. Please.
So one example when Dogen seems to denigrate or deconstruct and has a very negative view of imagery mm-hmm. is when he is in China and he sees paintings on a Chinese temple wall of the Indian patriarchs, right, of the arhats, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's one image of just a big round white circle on a Dharma seat. And he asks his Chinese guide, you know, who is this? And he's told, this is Nagarjuna manifesting the full moon Samadhi. And Dogen, you know, kind of rolls his, he thinks that this is ludicrous, that somebody literally interpreted Nagarjuna's full moon Samadhi as a big white round circle that he actually transformed his body somehow into a moon, right? And he sees artistic representation as being totally deluded and delusional deluding to the spectator, and so he denigrates that. And he does this, also he's got an ulterior motive. He wants to kind of show off how much more enlightened he is even than his Chinese hosts, right? And because he's coming back to Japan and he wants to set up his own shop and demonstrate that he actually has enlightened wisdom. So he's very, he critiques his Chinese host very, very severely. And he says that this is nothing but the painting of a rice cake. You know, it looks like a bowl of, you know, ball of mochi or something, you know? And so it's absolutely ludicrous. So that's one example when he is very negative about imagery and how representation can never represent, right, the enlightenment experience, like a full moon samadhi experience. There are other times, however, when he is very pro-image. And for this, his standpoint usually is can be from a post-experiential, you know, an enlightened perspective, when he says, you know, that all images are good, for example. And if you're just a novice starting out, obviously venerate the Buddha as but one of the three jewels, right? Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So it really kind of depends who, where and when he's speaking, like to whom he is speaking mm-hmm. and why and from what perspective he is speaking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
Yeah. No, it's very fascinating. Let's see. So I want to go backwards a little bit now. We've kind of we jumped ahead to the chapter on Dogen. Maybe let's move backwards to Kukai.
Sure.
And let's see. All right. Now I have to rethink how I want to ask this. Let's see. Could you maybe just start by saying a little bit about Kukai's take on images? We've talked a little bit about the whole Mikyo imagery, but maybe let's talk a little bit about Kukai and where images function within Mikyo practice.
Of course. Kukai, as I said, has this reputation for being very pro-image. Mm-hmm. At times he says, you can get enlightened in a single glance at the two world mandalas, mm-hmm. for example. And Cynthia Bogle has written a beautiful book with that title, from an art historical perspective. And he even says that the images, the two world mandalas that he brings back, specifically the womb world and the diamond world mandalas, which are always displayed as a pair, that they kind of condense the Dharma better than even words can, mm-hmm. right? So there's an interesting kind of text image, a privileging of text, of image over text there, which is interesting, and I kind of play with when I compare it with Dogen later. Kukai has this very pro-image take on the role of imagery in the Enlightenment experience. In his ritual practice as well, he argues very convincingly that all the rituals up until now have been good, but they haven't been empowered by these esoteric images, and we really need to set up a Shingon chapel within the imperial palace itself, and he does this right before he dies. So mm-hmm. he really kind of gets he gets his imperial patronage for these images as being the most efficacious ways to empower state protection, rain production, these sorts of esoteric rituals. At the same time, however, in his poetry, Kukai deconstructs the power of images, and that these mandalas, right, and mandalas are but two-dimensional blueprints for three-dimensional palaces, really. But in his poetry, he deconstructs these as but castles in the air, right, that they are nothing but emptiness, etc. So he has certainly built up a body of iconography, a whole iconographic system, which obviously he inherits from the continent. And he literally grounds it in new soil, right? Mm-hmm. In Japan, he transplants this esoteric system in terms of his stupas and his chapels and his, right in the capital itself, right? So he's literally grounding it in Japanese soil. But at the same time, he does recognize that these are empty, right? That these images actually are, perhaps you might say, are efficacious because they are empty, right? But we should not attach too much to them. But those are more in his private poetic moments, not so much in his public ritual agendas, really.
Right. Yeah. And when I think when you're talking about his public ritual agendas, you have this great term of inter-iconicity.
Ha! And, right.
Right. Perhaps you might like to talk about that and how this citation of icons functions within Mikyo practice.
Very elaborately.
Right.
So inter-iconicity perhaps my own neologism. I tend to like to do these things, like holochronic as well. I don't know. Right. I like words as much as I like images. So inter-iconicity is my attempt, my way of characterizing what I think is going on, or how I see this mm-hmm. incredibly elaborate iconographic system within esoteric Buddhism, within Mikyo. And the sampling of one iconic element within a new context allows for a kind of a new kind of vocabulary, a visual vocabulary with which Kukai can spell out new kind of ritual messages, you might say. He actually has a very elaborate theory he calls called Monji, M-O-N-J-I, or Mon, like boom. So Monji is like a pattern letter, you might say. That characterizes the entire world, really. So there's a kind of a consonance among sound, the word itself and the reality, the referent, the actual material object or thing or event that is being represented through sound and word. And that he lays out in his Shoji Jusogi fascicle. And so then building on that theory of monji, he actually uses the visual vocabulary of the mandalas, which really kind of show or illustrate all the different aspects of Dainichi throughout the world, in both compassionate as well as, so lotus as well as vajra, compassion as well as kind of adamantine wisdom aspects. And he will rearrange these figures in different ways, in different groupings, in order to, empower the space in different ways. Right. So, for example, at Toji, a very famous temple in Kyoto, right, where that Kukai established, he uses figures from the two world mandalas, but rearranges them in different ways to basically reflect the benevolent king's sutra in order to empower this urban temple in the capital in its state protecting role. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you have this kind of reservoir of images and meanings that you can recombine to respell out new realities in different ways. So that's really kind of interesting, I find, if you want to think of in terms of semiotics and things like this. Dogen, on the other hand, I kind of extend that metaphor even further. And if Kukai is going to have inter-iconicity, then I argue that Dogen has a sense of inter-temporality, right, as well. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's quite fascinating how they've both starting from kind of the same underlying tradition and developed in such different ways. And yet,
right,
I think one of the fascinating things about this book is you show that maybe they're not so different after all. Right? That perhaps maybe the difference has been overstated, I think, by that division of labor. Huh. You've talked about the start of it, right? We start to see both Kukai and Dogen as more whole people, perhaps, than if we just...
I think, yeah, I mean, ultimately, first of all, I don't want to give the impression that and facilely reduce the one to the other and say, right, oh yeah, they end up at the same place, and isn't that all like, right, happy and easy and good?
Mm-hmm.
Because they are different.
Right.
But at the same time... because they are different, they do definitely represent these two, I would say, complementary poles of, mm-hmm, Buddhist thought, vis-a-vis imagery and experience. At the same time, however, I would like to think, from my understanding, I think both do end up at a place of non-dualism, right?
Right.
They just kind of come at it from different angles. So, mm-hmm, from Kukai's side, you might say that he comes at it pro-image, but then empties that out. Dogen comes at it from the emptiness side first and then reaffirms the form.
Right.
You know, so yes, they're different, but I think their understanding maybe of the non-dualism of form and emptiness, also of practice or method and realization, mm-hmm, and enlightenment, right?
Right.
Are ultimately trying to get at the same place, just maybe through different angles.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've taken up quite a bit of your time, so I think we'll leave it to the reader to pick up your book and see how, in the end, you argue Dogen and Kukai both respond to the three framing questions. But maybe you'd like to say a little bit about what you're working on right now?
Ah, Thank you. Okay. Yes, I have. I am co-editing a volume with Zen scholar, senior Zen scholar Stephen Hine for Oxford on Zen and material culture. And this will bring religious studies scholars and art historians together in the same volume to look at the material and visual dimensions of Zen, both in, or actually across Rinzai, Soto, and we have Obaku as well.
Oh, wow. Excellent.
Yeah. And also trans history, going from early medieval actually up to the present. Greg Levine at Berkeley, actually an artist, a great Zen art historian, is going to be looking at retail Zen.
Oh,
right. And so it's very I think going to be an interesting book. And then I have another, I have a second idea for my second monograph, but I think it's too early to actually pitch that yet. I don't want to to box myself in, but it would be something along the lines of temple bodies. But we'll see if that, how many, this book took me a long time, so we'll see how many years or decades it's going to take me for the second. But I've got some good projects in the coming down the pike.
Well, excellent. It all sounds very exciting, and so we'll look forward to that co-edited volume with Stephen Hine, and yes. I guess we'll keep checking back in to see what form the second monograph takes.
We'll see. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you.